This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the American South. I'm your host, Brandon Jett. On today's podcast, I'm speaking with Dr. Faye A. Yarbrough, a professor of history at Rice University. Professor Yarbrough's research interests focus on the native populations of the southeastern United States and Indian Territory during the 19th century. She is particularly interested in the interactions between indigenous peoples and people of African descent. Her first book, Race and the Cherokee Nation, Sovereignty in the 19th Century, explores the complex relationship between the construction of sexual boundaries and the formation of tribal and racial identities. The study analyzes how Cherokee lawmakers used marriage laws to construct conceptions of race and gender in the face of Andrew Jackson's Indian policies, and how the Civil War and Reconstruction reconfigured the thinking of Cherokee legislatures. Today, we're talking about her most recent book, Choctaw Confederates, The American Civil War in Indian Country, published by UNC Press in 2021. This book is an engaging history of the Choctaw people from their resettlement in present-day Oklahoma in the 1830s through the Civil War and Reconstruction. Professor Yarbrough provides some insight into why the Choctaw and other Native peoples in Indian Country decided to cast their lot with the Confederacy during the Civil War and foregrounds Native experiences during the Civil War and Reconstruction. Dr. Yarbrough, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, what first brought this book to my attention was that it goes so far beyond what people usually think of when they think about Civil War histories. And so if I could just generalize for a second, to me, it seems like people usually think of the Civil War in very specific ways. It's kind of Northern white men fighting against Southern white men in places like Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, maybe Louisiana a little bit, and once up in Pennsylvania. And a lot of these battles and the larger confrontation over slavery was bound up in white people's understanding of the role of African descendant peoples in the United States. And your book kind of upends all of that in really fascinating and engaging ways, in that you're talking about how Native peoples interacted with the debates surrounding slavery, how they engaged with the Civil War and Reconstruction. So not only are you adding a new group of people into the mix, you also look at the Civil War in present-day Oklahoma, which again kind of stretches these geographic boundaries of what we typically conceive of as the South or the theater of the Civil War. So I think you just really blew all of my preconceived notions about the Civil War out of the water. And so I say all of that to ask you this. Where in the world did you come up with this kind of study and this kind of idea about engaging with Native Americans' interactions with enslaved people and slavery, and also the Civil War and Reconstruction more broadly?
So, well, first, thank you for all of those kind words. It's really heartening to hear that some of the goals that I had for this project are, in fact, what readers are getting out of it. You know, you put a lot of time and effort into a project and send it out into the world, and you're never quite sure what people are going to take from it. So this is really gratifying. So I would say the long story of how I got into this project, and I'm apologizing up front, it is a long story.
Oh, that's okay. We like long stories on here.
Great. Is that things began, this project really began in the archives. So when I was working on my dissertation, which became that first book, Race and the Cherokee Nation, I was in the archives in Oklahoma City, and I met a woman, Mildred Brown, who was a volunteer archivist there. And she saw me coming in day after day, sitting in front of the microfilm reader, scrolling through roll after roll of microfilm. And she stopped me one day and she said, "What are you doing? What are you working on?"
As all good archivists will, right?
Yeah, right. And she noticed me because she said, you must not be doing family research, right? Most of the people who go to the Oklahoma Historical Society's archive are doing genealogical research on their families. And, you know, she'd volunteered there for a while. And she said, "You don't seem like you're doing that." And I told her what I was working on. And she immediately said, "Oh, you should write about my family." Right. Which you'd be surprised, working on the topics that I do, how often people want to tell me about their
really?
Family. Yeah. Frequently people want to tell me about their family.
Is that a fantastic problem to have? So many people wanting to tell you their family histories, or does it become kind of a burden almost?
Well, it's a burden in that sometimes they tell me histories that, based on what I know about the historical record, may not be entirely true. And I don't want to be the person to say, I don't think that's how that happened.
So, right, right.
So I was, you know, but that was, I was a graduate student and, you know, I was intrigued. And so she starts telling me about her family. Mildred Brown is a descendant of a family that Dan Littlefield has written about, in which part of the family is descended from, is of Native and white ancestry. And then another part of the family, the father, after the death of the Native mother, had children with an enslaved woman.
Oh, wow.
But then attempted to free those children, took them out of state to have them declared free, et cetera. But when he dies, the Choctaw and white children attempt to have their half siblings re-enslaved. Right?
Oh my goodness.
Right. And so she tells me
this
story.
That's family history right there.
Right? And I was amazed, and she was really generous, and she gave me all of these materials that she had collected over time. I think part of her reason for volunteering in the archive was to be able to conduct her own family research. Right. And so she let me photocopy all of these records. And I actually thought I was embarking on a project to think about memory in a more concrete way, because, as I said, she was a descendant of the Choctaw and white side of the Beams family. That's their her ancestors are the Beams. And she had met someone who was a descendant of the Choctaw and African side of the family. And, you know, they had talked, and I was really interested in thinking about talking to both of these women and asking how their families talked about this history, right? So I imagined a really concrete way to think about memory and talk about memory, and that was the goal. So after I finished my dissertation, I'm in the archives, you know, doing work to revise the dissertation to become a book manuscript. And also then embarking on this new project and thinking, okay, well, I'm going to look at the Choctaw Nation and let's look at legislative documents and see what's happening. And I find this piece of legislation in which Choctaw legislators are saying they want to declare any statement made against the Confederacy treason, and treason is punishable by death, right? And so it was this, you know, you find this piece of legislation recorded in, you know, this 19th century script, and it made me pause. Wow, really? You're so committed to the Confederacy that you want to declare saying something negative about the Confederate Army treason, and treason is punishable by death. So I fell into this other rabbit hole of why? What is so appealing about the Confederacy or Confederate ideology that you would support the Confederacy a few short decades after those very same people were pushing you out of the Southeast and into Indian territory? So I'm embarrassed to Miss Brown to say that I actually didn't end up thinking about her family so much in writing that story, but this just took me in a different direction of then thinking about, okay, what does this participation mean? How do they come to this decision? Right. So that led to, you know, the chapters in the book that are about thinking about slavery and what it looked like in the Choctaw Nation, thinking about the process of arriving to this decision to side with the Confederacy, then trying to figure out what that military experience was like, right? And then what Reconstruction looked like. So that's the long story of how I came to this project. It's really Miss Mildred Brown, she's in Oklahoma, stopping me in the archive and saying, oh, but you should write about my family. Right.
That's absolutely wonderful.
Right. Giving me this treasure trove of documents. Yeah, it was really generous of her and fortuitous. And sometimes when I talk to my students about what I like about being a historian and what's appealing to me, it's the personal, it's the individual stories. It's the fact that you can see how those stories have an impact on where we are now, right? But it was really grew out of just, you know, that really simple question from her.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's so funny how many big time history books and important works grow out of conversations with archivists. You know, I think we all had that experience where we go into the archives expecting to look for, be interested in one thing. And we had this one-off conversation, perhaps, with an archivist who, you know, have spent significant chunks of their lives cultivating these collections, and all of a sudden they just launch us down these other tracks. And I think that's one of the really amazing things about talking to historians about their work, and even archivists about their work too, is just how these collaborative things really kind of emerge. I always find that interesting. So, and to be fair, that story was not all that long. I was a little worried you were going to go into like the 30 or 40 minute mark, but yeah, a 7 minute story about the birth of a book is absolutely fantastic. And you brought up a point that really drew me in. Well, there were a couple of points you brought up that really drew me in. The first is how you start, I think it's the first chapter of the introduction, and you have this quote by, it's Peter Pitchlin, and you make the claim that in many cases, the Choctaw were more committed to the Confederate cause than the white Southerners were. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh my gosh, now I have to finish the rest of this book, right? Like, I can't skim this. I need to know why they were more committed to the Confederate cause than white Southerners in many cases. And so I guess I'll ask the question that I'm assuming is on everybody's minds who buys your book or listens to this interview. Why in the world did the Choctaw and other Native American groups side with the Confederacy? It seemingly just goes against everything we assume about white Southerners' relationships with non-white people, and the flip side of that. So could you just elaborate a little bit and answer that one question that I know everybody's going to want an answer to? What in the heck happened there?
Yeah, so I make the argument that there are two parts to this answer of why Choctaws would side with Confederates. So one part is they are slaveholders, and they, you know, slaveholding is a part of their economy. In some ways, it's a little bit different in terms of the prime crop being grown. Choctaws place more value in these natives in Indian territory who are engaged in large plantation agriculture, put more resources in the growing of corn than white Southerners do. So, you know, the mix of how they're growing things is a little bit different, but they are also growing cotton, and they're growing it for the market. So there's the element of slavery and their commitment to a particular social order that comes out of the enslavement of people of African descent, right? So they're passing laws that clearly disadvantaged people of African descent, right? So there's that part of the story that's more familiar. The other part of the story is that the Choctaw Nation is interested in protecting sovereignty. They're interested in protecting Native sovereignty. And they see the Confederates as the their best bet in terms of protecting Native sovereignty. So when sometimes I make this joke that historians of the American South, but U.S. historians in general, when we talk about the causes of the Civil War, and we point to slavery, and we say, right, it's states, when Southerners say it's about states' rights, it's about states' rights to protect slavery. I argue that Choctaws hear states' rights and they're equating it to Native sovereignty. And they are believing that states' rights is a real and important part of the reason to support the war, right? How can people who espouse a commitment to states' rights then not recognize and respect Native rights to sovereignty, right? Mm-hmm. And that they are making this equation, and also that Southerners are continuing to make promises that that's what they're going to do. And they're making promises about what they're going to pay for in terms of the war effort, mm-hmm. right? That they're going to reimburse the Choctaws for this, that they are going to honor all of the commitments that the federal government has made in terms of respecting sovereignty, but also in terms of financial obligations that they have, right? That the Choctaw Nation already has plenty of evidence, and these other Native nations have plenty of evidence that the federal government is not going to honor past treaties. But here, these Southern lawmakers and emissaries that are sent out are saying, no, but we will
right.
honor those treaty obligations. We're going to make these financial commitments. We're going to honor these financial commitments. The Confederate government and their emissaries also are recognized that the Choctaws and other Native nations, that they're the funds that they've received from land sales in the past are invested in Southern businesses, right? Right. And then the agents that the federal government has been sending to these Native nations, many of them are from the South, right? So there are all these factors that are pushing them, right, to side with the South. And then if you think about the practice of slavery, buying and selling slaves and cotton in Southern markets, right? Marrying white Southerners, right? So there are those kinds of ties that are connecting people. There's the promises that the Confederate government is making about honoring sovereignty. I would argue that the Choctaws also connect their identity to their ability to maintain sovereignty, right? That they also are trying to maintain their identity as a people. Mm-hmm. So all of these things seem like they're going to happen if they side with the Confederacy. And of course, the Confederacy is putting pressure on them. There are people from Texas and Arkansas who are making incursions and making demands of the Native nations to side with the Confederacy. But I would argue that the Choctaws have incentive on their own without those pressures to side with the South in the war. And it makes absolutely perfect sense to them to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you bring this up several times in the book. One, slavery was an institution that they were very familiar with. It had been around for quite some time. And that's something I'd like to come back to in just a moment. But you raise an interesting point, suggesting that they thought they'd be better off casting their lot with the Confederates, that they would protect those claims to sovereignty. And in the book, you bring up the fact that, as you briefly mentioned here, they are from the South. They live in the South. They have familiarity with white Southerners. Do you think this was also about just kind of thumbing their nose at the federal government also, and maybe seeing them as the perpetrators of all of those problems that had befallen the Choctaw people before, because you bring up in the book that yes, the federal government has a policy of Indian removal, but it's also happening at the state level too, where state actors are also pushing Native peoples off their land. So do you think that there was just more of a distrust of the federal government, or was it that they felt more connected and tied to the Confederacy, or just an element maybe of both?
I think it has to be both. I think that they do have already a proven track record of the federal government not honoring treaties. And they don't even have to only look at their own treaties. They can look at other Native nations and see, oh yeah, the federal government lies to you too, right? So I think there's that. I think there are, again, there, as I talk about in the book, there are all these cultural and economic ties with the Confederacy. And again, the Confederacy is making all of these promises. I think you can debate whether or not the Confederacy is being honest in their making of these promises, right? But they are making all of these promises to these Native nations about what they're going to honor, what they're going to do. There's a way in which sometimes I think that the Choctaws and other Native nations are really optimistic, right? Because they're willing to try again. Okay, maybe this time they will honor these agreements. Maybe this time they are going to honor our claims to sovereignty. So I think there's an element of both of those things at play, you know, the ties that they're forging with Southerners, but also, again, this track record of the federal government just over and over again falling short of its commitments, falling short of the promises that they've made. Mm-hmm. To Native peoples.
And so if I could just kind of flip the script a little bit, why were the Confederates so interested in having Choctaw and other Native nations ally with them? And I guess the flip side would also be, why was the federal government also interested in courting these Native nations?
Well, part of the problem is for the Southerners is geography, and they're nervous about Indian territory, right? Present day Oklahoma. If this is, a territory that sides with the Union, it's making an incursion into Southern territory. And what could the federal government do if they're using that as a base of operations and fanning out into the South, right? So there's the strategic importance of the area. And you could argue that initially the federal government is not so interested because they pull troops out, right? Mm-hmm, like they pull... Mm-hmm. They pull back in Indian territory. And later, after the war, you'll see some of the rhetoric among the Choctaws change to say, well, but what could we have done? The federal government abandoned us, right? So the federal government sends resources elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's also the part of the equation is that the Confederate army is there, the Confederate government is there saying, please, please, please join us, join us, join us. We'll give you all of these things.
Right.
At the same moment that the federal government is pulling resources away. And so you can imagine from the perspective of a lot of these Native nations that they're saying, well, yeah, actually the Confederate government is more interested in us. Mm-hmm. They are more invested than what the federal government is showing us right now.
And it was a real time example of yet again, the federal government abandoning their commitments to Native peoples. So even if you said, well, that was in the past, they're not going to do it again. No, they are literally doing it right now.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow. You bring up that the institution of slavery was something that was part of the Choctaw Nation. And as I was reading through the book and listening to you talk about it a little bit, I was just reminded of Ira Berlin's argument about how slavery looks different depending on, you know, what time period you're talking about, what geographic location you're talking about. And so I wonder if you could just briefly explain, you already hit it on a little bit, but how was it that slavery got introduced into Choctaw Nation, and what did slavery look like in the Choctaw Nation that may have been similar or different to what we typically assume of like plantation style agriculture producing cotton?
Yeah, so slavery exists among indigenous populations long before the arrival of Europeans. As I say to my students in class all the time, People have been enslaving other people who look just like them from time immemorial. And what's different about the New World is that suddenly people are thinking of color coding enslavement, right? That targeting specific group people of African descent for enslavement. So, but this older practice of enslavement among Native populations, I would recommend looking at Christina Snyder's book, for instance, if you want to read more about that. But this older practice is different from what we see when Choctaws transition in the 18th century to enslaving people of African descent. And it's different in that enslaved people are usually war captives, right? So folks that have been captured in the process of war, sometimes mourning wars, meaning mourning, I feel sad, not mourning in the morning, right? where groups are specifically making war in order to replenish their population, right? So in this older, more traditional practice, you're enslaving people who are war captives. The enslavement isn't permanent. The slave enslavement isn't inherited, right? So mothers aren't passing it to their children. And the enslavement isn't, your labor isn't being used just for agricultural labor in this more traditional practice. So people can move out of enslavement. Sometimes people are enslaved, but then adopted into the family to replace a fallen or lost loved one, right? So that's the traditional practice. So then with the arrival of Europeans and the introduction of the enslavement of people of African descent, you see this transition of aiming enslavement, thinking of enslavement as something that only people of African descent can, a status that only they can hold, using them for those enslaved people for agricultural labor, permanent status, inherited status, right? So that's the change, the difference. And in Choctaw Nation, enslavement, so it's really interesting because there are some descriptions of slavery among Native nations as being somehow more lenient, right? That enslaved people there in the 19th century are able to work more independently, or that Native enslavers aren't exercising as much authority over them, you know, giving them a little bit more freedom. I think people especially like to take the quote, oh, I'm totally going to not remember his name. But there's a narrative of an enslaved man who says, if I had to be a slave, I would rather be the slave of an Indian, right? Because they have more of the milk of human kindness in them. So there's that way of thinking about what slavery might have looked like among Native populations. But then you have the other part of the problem, which is especially in kinship-based societies, which the Choctaws are figured matrilineally and are kinship-based, people outside of kin, like enslaved people, don't really have any rights or protections. And so things can be done to those people without any repercussion. And so that the authority can be much more total and the treatment can be much more brutal, right? And so the example I always use in class is the example of an Indian agent. So an agent from the federal government that's among the Cherokees, return Meigs, and in the 19th century. And he writes in his report, and he's kind of horrified by what he's seen. There's a Cherokee, he describes it as a Cherokee woman who didn't like something that her enslaved person, an enslaved Black person did, harangues her husband until he finally goes and kills this enslaved person, chops off his head, they throw the body in the river. And when the agent goes to the couple and says, what are you doing? You can't do that. He writes that they're perplexed because they say, well, but he was a slave and he doesn't have any rights, right, that they're bound to respect. And so I would describe the treatment that enslaved people to indigenous masters, the treatment that they might receive, as much like the treatment that enslaved people in the broader South would might receive. That there's a continuum. It depends a lot on the master, right? The enslaver. It could be kinder. It can be really harsh, right? That there is a continuum. What is different in the Choctaw Nation is that there are fewer laws to limit the behavior of enslavers. So, you know, in southern states, you'll find rules about, in some states, about too harsh punishment or the crime of murder. And you don't see that in the legislative record in the Choctaw Nation, right? So again, if you think about enslaved people being outside kinship and having this total control over these folks, then that makes sense, right? You also see similar laws that you see in southern states that, you know, prohibiting literacy or, right, or interracial sex or those kinds of things. So there are a lot of similarities. As I said, there's this perception of enslaved, of Native enslavers as being more lenient, but wrapped in some of that perception is also some racism, because some of the contemporary observers will say things such as, oh, well, that Indian master doesn't know how to control his slave. Or those slaves are so lazy because he does, you know, he hasn't, that Indian master doesn't know what he's doing. Is it that that's what's happening? Or is it that there's some racism on the part of the commenter in that, right, in the 19th century, who's making an observation and saying that?
Were there notions of paternalism? So, I mean, however faulty or fraudulent that may have been for white Southerners to kind of perceive their enslaved people as extensions of their family, and that there was some semblance of protection that they provided. Was that concept present in Native societies as well, or was that something that was kind of just in white Southern society?
Oh no, you definitely see in some of the a couple of letters from within the Pitchland family who were slaveholders, you know, a comment about, oh, similar to that, my family, black and white, right? Right? Or say howdy to the Negroes for me, right? Like that kind of thing. So there is, and also that same kind of surprise when enslaved people are running away or misbehaving, that same kind of, but I've treated them so well. Why would they do that, right? There is some of that same language there, yes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I could spend the entire time talking to you about this decision to side with the Confederacy or slavery in Choctaw Nation. And you do a really great job of kind of painting that picture and demonstrating the complexity behind the decision and the nuance behind the decisions and the role of slavery in Choctaw society. But I think another thing you do really well in this book is you don't just stop the story there. You go into the experiences of Choctaw people during the Civil War and Reconstruction. And so I'd like to spend a little bit of time just talking about that, since that is one of the really fantastic things about this book, is that you push those boundaries of what we assume the Civil War was about and where it was fought. what was the Civil War like in Indian country in present day Oklahoma? And what role did the Choctaw play in the Confederacy's attempts to fend off the Union?
Well, it's really interesting because some of the Native nations in their agreements to fight with the Confederacy, and the Choctaw is one of them, say that they can't be asked to go outside of Indian territory unless they give their explicit permission to do so. Right. So it's an interesting moment of asserting sovereignty, also asserting your support of the war. However, wanting the Confederacy to recognize, but our obligation is here first. Our obligation is here in Indian territory first. So I think the based on what you see in the records, the military records that I mine for the book, it sounds like the picture of the war that the soldiers give is that it's it would sound very familiar to people who study the Civil War in the South. They're poorly provisioned, right? Supplies
despite don't all those up, promises, right?
Right, exactly. Supplies don't show up as they should. Promised, you know, clothing and food, et cetera, don't show up as they should. Then it's they talk about it. It sounds like periods of relative little action punctuated by these bursts of really frightening, bewildering, dangerous battles. And then, you know, a stretch of kind of routine, you know, activity. And then again, another punctuated by another moment of clashing troops and, fierce fighting. So I think that part of it would look very familiar to other folks who study the Civil War or read about the Civil War in the larger South, right? But they're so poorly provisioned that a white officer writes to Confederate officials to complain and say, if they don't support us anymore, it's our fault because we didn't give them the things that we promised to give them, even though they've been so loyal and supportive to us.
Were Choctaw fighters or warriors, did they travel outside of Indian country or their own territory to engage in battles with the Confederate military as well? Or did they largely stay confined to present day Oklahoma?
They did travel out a little bit. The example that people usually look at is Tandy Walker takes some troops because he's cited as being a part of depredations made against colored troops, right? And, you know, even some Southern observers are saying, wow, they were really ferocious and treated those colored troops so badly, right? So there are moments when they're outside of Indian territory, but they really, again, I think it's very instructive that they're so clear about wanting to have control over where they fight, right? That they're asserting their sovereignty in that way, that they don't have to go unless they agree to go. And not, again, not all of the Native nations have that written into their agreements with the Confederate government, but the Choctaws don't, you know, are clear about wanting to maintain that sovereignty.
And I think that really builds on the argument that you made earlier about why they decided to side with the Confederacy at the outset, which was to protect their sovereignty. And so it seems like at the very beginning, they are asserting that right again and again and again. So obviously the Confederacy loses. The side that the Choctaw chose to ally with is defeated, and they also have to go through a period of Reconstruction, much like the rest of the South. So in what ways did Reconstruction unfold in Indian territory and in the Choctaw Nation in particular? What did that look like? Was it also similar to Reconstruction across the South, or was there something particularly unique about it?
So what's really unique about what happens in Indian territory, so they have to, all of these Native nations that side with with the Confederacy, have to reestablish friendly relations with the federal government. They have to negotiate treaties with the federal government that include provisions for the abolition of slavery, and then for the inclusion of their formerly enslaved people into their polity, mm-hmm. right? And so that those people are going to be granted citizenship, that the freed people will be granted citizenship. So that kind of process is similar as to what happens in the American South. What's really different is that groups such as the Choctaw own land communally. And so that means that those freed people, when they become citizens in Choctaw Nation, are also going to have access to land, mm-hmm. which is very different than what happens in the American Absolutely. South, right? And Crystal Feimster, I was at a conference with her many, I don't know, in the before times.
before Which seems like forever ago.
right, long ago. And she made a comment that, oh, so Indian Territory is a place where you could see what happens if freed people had been given land, right? If 40 acres of and a mule were not just a thing that we say now in the mm-hmm. present, but if 40 acres and a mule had been made a reality, if some kind of reparations were provided for newly emancipated people in the moment. So in Choctaw Nation, the part of the treaty agreement is that they have to accept these folks as citizens, again, which is going to give newly emancipated people access to land. And the Choctaw Nation initially says, the treaty tells the federal government demands that they do this, and then says, and we're going to give you some funds for doing this, right? Mm-hmm. And the Choctaw Nation's response is, keep your money and take these people. Mm-hmm. So there's a period until about 1883 when they pass legislation to deal with this in the Choctaw Nation, where it's unclear what the status of those Choctaw freed people is mm-hmm. there. So it would appear that many of them do farm on plots of land unmolested, mm-hmm. but the federal government and the Choctaw Nation keep having this argument where the federal government says, well, but you haven't made provision for this. And the Choctaw Nation says, and you can take these people, right? Right. We're answering. We are giving you an answer. And the answer is to take these people. And the federal government has given them part of the money that they said you have, after you've made provision for these people, we're giving you this money. And the federal government gave them part of the money before the Choctaw Nation made provision. So you can imagine from the perspective of Choctaw lawmakers, well, they don't mean it, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We don't have to take action with these people. So as I said, it would appear that a lot of folks still actually farmed, a lot of freed people farmed and were there, but it's not until 1883 that it becomes explicit and clear legally, okay, these freed people will have citizenship rights. These are what citizenship rights entail. Mm-hmm. And they have access to plots of land, right? The land that they can access is less than Choctaw citizens, quote unquote, by blood. So it is different, but they do have access to land. And there's work by other scholars that suggests that some of these plots that freed people are able to receive and maintain in Indian Territory are then going to be founding plots for some of the all-Black towns that emerge in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And that some of the founding plots that for Tulsa, for instance, yeah. and the Greenwood District are plots that were... land obtained by freed people, right, from Native nations. So to go back to, historian Crystal Feimster saying, well, maybe this is an example of what could happen, right? Mm-hmm. There is a way in which there's an example of, there's something to be learned there about what can happen when newly emancipated people are given access to land and are able to farm it. Or find it really powerful when you read about how even the idea of 48 acres and a mule emerged, you know, with Special Field Order 15 mm-hmm. and Sherman's meeting with a Black minister at the time, I think Mr. Frazier, who says that freedom is the ability to till the land and enjoy the fruits of your labor, right? That's an amazing right. definition of freedom. I ask my students all the time, if I ask you to define freedom right now, how would you do
it? I do that too.
Right?
Every single time. And the responses are just so wide ranging, or there's just dead silence.
Yeah, but it's never the freedom to own land and till it by your own right. hand and enjoy the fruits of your labor. They don't ever say something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that this is a moment in which for many people of African descent in the United States, that freedom would be so tied to the idea of land ownership, right? If you think about that in the moment of Special Field Order 15, and then people in Indian Territory, people, newly emancipated people who are actually able to own land and till mm-hmm. it by their own hand, right? And enjoy the fruits of their labor. It's a powerful way of thinking about how they're experiencing what emancipation means.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not hard to make the leap of how those plots of land could lead to the development of places like Greenwood in
yeah.
Tulsa.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I end my book with the flip side of that, the negative is that then we see what happens in Greenwood.
Yeah.
Right? That the response to land ownership and economic success by these African Americans is sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And people, you know, white Tulsans aren't happy that this is the case, right? But it does give you again, there is something in Reconstruction in Indian Territory that gives you an idea of what that could have looked like if people across the South, if newly emancipated people across the South had been given that access to land.
Absolutely. You preempted most of my next questions about, you know, the all Black towns that emerge in Oklahoma, which there are many, and Greenwood in particular. But you're absolutely right. Even this opportunity that these newly emancipated people had in places like present day Oklahoma, even that is fleeting. Whenever it stokes the ire mm-hmm. of white Americans, and Greenwood being perhaps the best example of just how fleeting that can be. I wonder what the long-term consequences for the Choctaw people and other Native groups in places like present-day Oklahoma that decided to join forces with the Confederacy, if their concerns were over sovereignty. What were the long-term consequences of that decision to go against the federal government and then end up on the losing side of that battle? Were there any stark consequences for their sovereignty?
Oh, absolutely. Because the federal government can then use this as a pretext to make inroads on Native sovereignty, right?
Right.
So part of the punishment can be you're going to have to give up more land, right? Part of the punishment is that we can tell you who you have to make a citizen and who... Mm-hmm. who you have to include, right? So that the consequences, you know, we've talked mostly about what Reconstruction in Indian Territory means for people of African descent, but for the Native population, again, this is the pretext for the federal government to really, I think in the view of many federal officials, to punish Native people for making the wrong choice in the mm-hmm. war, right? That this is the way that you can punish them is by taking away parts of Native sovereignty, you know, taking away territory, demanding territory, right? So the consequences for those Native nations are stark and mm-hmm. profound, right? In terms of, especially in terms of what it means for Native sovereignty.
Yeah, and especially when you think about the consequences for Southerners, for you know, seceding and going to war with the federal government, it seems like those two consequences weren't necessarily similar in terms of their outcomes, especially when you think about the sovereignty question.
Yeah. Well. And, you know, one of the, if I might plug a former graduate student, Jeff Fortney, I mean, he writes about the lack of, for instance, Civil War monument building among Native populations, right? That they're not relitigating and and thinking about the Civil War, commemorating things in the same way that other Southerners are, right? Because the consequences have different meanings for them.
Right. Oh, yeah. I didn't even think about that. And, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, like, I wonder if the sons of Confederate veterans would be terribly excited about reaching out to Choctaw descendants, or the flip, right? Would Choctaw descendants be interested in that kind of organization based on the outcomes of the war? Well, we've got a little bit of time left, and I feel like I wouldn't be a historian if I didn't ask you something about sources. In the beginning, you do a fantastic job of putting it all on the table in terms of what your goals were in finding sources. You really wanted to foreground Choctaw voices and experiences. But you note that sometimes there are gaps that you have to try to fill in. And I think that's always an interesting question that historians have to grapple with. So you took this approach of using something you called side streaming to fill in some of those gaps. I wonder if you could just briefly explain to some of our listeners what side streaming is and how you use that to kind of complete the narratives and the arguments that you were making.
Yeah, so a really clear example is in that, for instance, I use a lot of WPA, Works Progress Administration, mm-hmm. slave narratives. And for people who aren't familiar, there are these interviews that are conducted by the federal government in the wake of the Great Depression to put writers to work. And it's actually the project comes out of work that was happening with Black scholars and historically Black institutions who had been going out and interviewing the survivors of enslavement, right? Recognizing that they were getting older and, you know, that their memories would be of value. And so, you know, the federal government sends folks out to interview formerly enslaved people. And now you can readily access these online if mm-hmm. any of your listeners are interested. Or here at Rice University, you can go to the library and there's 50 volumes divided by state. So I use these WPA slave narratives because they get at the voice of enslaved people. But if I only used narratives that were left by people enslaved by Choctaws, I would have very few indeed. Mm-hmm. So instead, you know, you sidestream, you widen it so that you look at what's happening among enslaved people, among the Cherokees or among the Chickasaws or among the Creeks or among the Seminoles, right? That you broaden your net and look at what's happening close by geographically among Native nations to try to fill in the gaps because you only have a few that are from people who had been enslaved by Choctaw natives. Mm-hmm. So that's one kind of example. Or thinking about like if you're looking at what's happening legally in the Choctaw Nation, you might also then again go look at what's happening legislatively in the Cherokee Nation to see what's going on. Maybe they're borrowing laws from each other. Maybe the same kind of sentiment is mm-hmm. producing similar laws, right? So that kind of thing. It's really invaluable because otherwise it would be really hard to try to paint a fuller picture of what's right. happening. Yeah. And as you said, I'm really interested in centering the voices of Native people here. And in the chapter on in which I use a lot of the WPA stuff, centering the voices of enslaved people, right? Thinking mm-hmm. about the perspective of people that we don't always hear from in the historical narrative, and then looking to see if it tells us something different when you listen to these other voices. Do they mm-hmm. have a different perspective? Does it reframe or reshape how we're thinking about these events that we think we know a lot about if right. we do that, right? And, you know, the other thing I would say about especially thinking about the Civil War in the West, thinking about the Civil War in Indian Territory, is that a lot of the things that happen there, if you think about how the federal government is approaching, should these people be citizens of the United States? Should Native people be citizens of the United States? How are you going to push them to accept formerly enslaved people as citizens? The kinds of questions that happen there are the same kinds of questions that the federal government is dealing with, thinking about addressing with its own enslaved population, right? So that you can see the echoes of what's happening there shaping some of what's happening in federal policy in other parts of the United States.
And so do you think it's fair to say that because you relied on the process of side streaming in some cases, that the experience of enslaved people across Native nations, at least in the Southeast, were very similar?
I think there are a lot of similarities, yeah. Though a lot of scholars who look at the so-called five civilized tribes, in quotes, right, often we'll talk about the Native nations as on a kind of continuum in terms of what slavery looks like. Usually people will put the Seminoles on the least harsh, right? And then have a continuum in which the Chickasaws are on the most harsh, right? Okay. So there is some variation there, right? In terms of overall what people think slavery looked like in the Native nations. But there are some similarities that we can see across them.
Okay, wonderful. I want to ask you one last question, and that is kind of big picture stuff. So you've got this fantastic book, you kind of delve into to these very specific histories of the Choctaw people, and you illuminate the experience of some enslaved people in Choctaw Nation and some particular Choctaw people, like Peter Pitchland a lot. But like big picture stuff, what do you hope readers take away from this book? Like if you could narrow it down to like one or two things, just when they finish your book, you hope they take what away?
Oh gosh, that is a great question. And people can already, your listeners already know I'm a wordy person. So to break things down.
Oh, please don't think you're too terribly wordy. There are wordy people. You're fantastic.
To break things down to what's... what I'm always striving for in my classes with my students and in my scholarly work is I want readers or students to come away saying, oh, I never knew that. Mm-hmm. I never thought about that. Right. Like, so the first part is I want it to be something new. And then the second thing I would say is that I want people to have a sense that the question of race is far more complicated than we might imagine, right? That how we think about race has really changed a lot over time. That in the U.S., we tend to focus on the black-white dichotomy, that there's this line, and we ignore all of these other groups that have been here before the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. Groups that have been here before the beginning. And so I hope that another part of what people see is not just that race is complicated, but that we need to think about other groups and what their perspective might be. And I guess the third thing that I hope folks get out of the book is that the United States is not always the center of the story. Let's think a little bit more capaciously about the history that happens in this country, and that it's not always just this American story, that other groups are here, they're participating in really important ways, that it's, you know, I want to decenter the United States a little bit and think a little bit more broadly.
Well, I can say with 100% confidence you achieved those three goals and more. As I mentioned to you when we were speaking earlier, my wife, who is not a fan of reading history books, saw the cover of your book and asked me to explain it very briefly and was absolutely enthralled by it. And the arguments that you put out there, I think that central question of why in the world did the Choctaw side with the Confederacy is one that anybody who hears is all of a sudden going to be incredibly fascinated by. So again, congratulations on a fantastic book. I absolutely enjoyed every single page of it. So Professor Yarbrough, thank you so much for being on the show, on the podcast. Again, listeners, the book is Choctaw Confederates, the American Civil War in Indian Country. It is now available through UNC Press, and I'm assuming every other online retailer if you are interested in pursuing it through those routes. So again, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.